Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. In our modern medical world, death has become more of an anomaly than an accepted natural conclusion to life. For many of us, being present when a loved one dies can be both incredibly meaningful, but also disconcerting to say the least. Pre-death dreams and visions, though a natural part of the dying process, are one such phenomenon that can cause distress for family members at the bedside of a dying individual. They have seldom been studied or written about until now. Dr. Chris Kerr is a hospice doctor in Buffalo, New York. He and his colleagues have cared for thousands of patients over the years who, in the face of death, talk of finding love, insight, and grace in such pre-death dreams and visions. In his new book, Death is But a Dream, Finding Hope and Meaning at Life's End, Kerr shares his patients' stories of the emotional transition between life and death and the visions they have experienced. Visions range from long-lost relatives coming back to reassure, to wounds that can now be healed or conflicts revisited, ideally leading to forgiveness ready to be achieved. Dr. Kerr's work has been featured in the New York Times, Atlantic Monthly, and the BBC, among others. He gave a TEDx talk that has garnered over 2 million views. Dr. Chris Kerr, CEO of Hospice Buffalo and author of Death is But a Dream, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Chris Kerr, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by having you talk about how you define a pre-death dream.
Sure. Obviously, the patient population, there are people who have a terminal diagnosis, and somewhere in their kind of trajectory as they're getting worse, where they have experiences that are distinct. And that's defined in a lot of ways qualitatively. But they're, you know, in and around the big issues of having lived or facing death that are qualitatively very different than any normal dreams. And in fact, actually, that's a thing probably we hear the most, is people will say typically, you know, you don't understand. I don't normally dream, or this was very different. So subjective events that would be in a category of end of life.
And, you know, I guess one of the things that your book taught me is that a lot of times families have a really hard time with these dreams. They think that their loved one is suffering, and they think maybe that their loved one is delirious or having side effects from medication. And you point out these are very distinct. These are dreams, not delusions. This is not side effects from medication. And I guess, how do you determine that?
So there's a couple of things. One and two, you know, we've studied well over 1,000 people to date. And to participate in our formalized studies, you have to have clear cognition. You know, you have to sign consent forms that acknowledge that you're aware of the risks and whatnot. So you have to be clear-minded. It is a difficult question because most people, in going from living to death, have confusional states or alterations in awareness, and often delirium, which is, as you know, a fulminant state of confusion. The biggest difference is that confused people are often tangential. They're all over the place. They're often frightened. They're typically agitated. Versus the people who are having end-of-life experiences where they're really given a tremendous amount of insight. They're very well-organized thoughts thematically. They come out of it with a deeper understanding and usually comforted rather than distressed. So the biggest difference between the two is one has how they present, but how they're made feel. So delirious patients is again distressed, whereas these folks are generally comforted. The other important point is, and this is why we film patients, because we knew people would automatically make assumptions that these folks were very confused or medicated or deoxygenated, etc. So what we did is we filmed them, and we started far upstream of death. So we're not talking about the moments before death or the hours before death. We're often talking days, weeks, and sometimes even months. And these people are very functional. If you've seen any of the patient videos, they're obviously very intact.
I should say that I've seen a couple of the videos. You have a TEDx talk that you know somebody can find from Google, and you show a couple of patient videos in there.
If you go to Hospice Buffalo YouTube, you go to Hospice Buffalo playlist, there's a large number. And the funny thing is those films that we did earlier, which were really done to prove a point within the healthcare community, actually became the basis of a documentary and parts of a Netflix production.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. That's great. So now these pre-death dreams, what's very notable about them is that often the patient who's dying or has a terminal diagnosis has dreams about people who are deceased, often family members or friends or people from childhood. I guess, what's going on?
Well, it's interesting. So what we did that was very different is we put some rigor to how we studied this, and we gave people questionnaires, and we interviewed them daily right up until death. They were coming into our inpatient unit, so it's a freestanding unit where people come who are nearing death or need symptom management. And on the questionnaire was a menu list where you clicked off what you were dreaming of. And what we found a couple of things. One is there was a tendency, there was an increase in frequency dramatically as people approached death. And in terms of content, the most predominant theme was seeing people who you knew, who you loved, and who had passed. And we also measured comfort to theme, and it was interesting in that the highest score of comfort came with seeing the deceased. So if you put all the data points together, there's this built-in mechanism within the dying process where as you're approaching death, you're having an increased frequency of seeing or experiencing the presence of deceased who you loved, and they're overwhelmingly comforting.
It's so interesting, too, because as we talked about, the caregivers and family, the living family members who are often at the bedside of the dying patient, they get distressed by hearing their loved one who is in the dying process talk about people who are deceased, who are no longer among the living. And so I think this book provides a real value for family members of dying patients to know that not only is it normal, so to speak, for dying patients to have dreams about deceased individuals, but in fact, it's probably helpful.
Yeah, overwhelmingly. We've actually interviewed, I think, 770 family members now, and the adage is true that what's good for the patient is good for their loved one. And over 40% of family members surveyed acknowledging seeing this within their loved one, which was really fascinating because there usually wasn't somebody there to translate it. And predominantly they saw it as comforting, and then it was comforting for them. And, you know, the examples are many. If you had a couple who were married together 6 decades and they had, you know, lost a baby at birth, and the husband's looking down on his life partner and she's referring to the baby, that recontextualizes loss and, not surprisingly, his grief. We've actually applied grief scales and found positive grief impact from having seen or experienced these events.
And these are on the patients themselves that's
yes.
consent
yes.
to be so in the
study.
This
isn't a bereaved dreaming. This is a family member, loved one, watching their dying loved one having these experiences. And if you think about it, it just redefines another paradigm. So instead of just seeing physical loss, diminishing of a person, they're actually very much vibrant at some level experientially. So it just puts a positive light on what is otherwise seen as grim.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Chris Kerr. He is the CEO and Chief Medical Officer of Hospice Buffalo and author of the new book, Death is But a Dream, Finding Hope and Meaning at Life's End. And as we've been talking about, his Hospice Buffalo has been doing research for years into people in the dying stage who experienced a lot of dreaming, often about deceased persons. And Chris, I want to ask you about the research. You write in the book about having to design your first research study and take this to what's called an institutional review board. These are the boards that hospitals and universities have that their main job is to protect the vulnerable. And of course, people who are dying are notably vulnerable. So they were quite skeptical, I think, initially that people advised you that you were going to have a hard time passing muster with the IRB.
Yeah, they actually shut me down in the first round. And I went in kind of on appeal and spoke to them directly. And it was really interesting. I asked them, you know, who actually had taken care of a dying person. They hadn't.
And nobody on the IRB had taken care of a dying patient,
right? Who had actually professionally who did this clinically? It was important because you know there's a tendency for us to sterilize the dying, to put them on a shelf, create quiet and calm. And while that's what many people want, actually most people want to feel connected And dying is lonely. Most people are looking up at a stark white ceiling. And it was interesting in the book, and I point this out in the acknowledgement, that not a single person or family who was approached said no, which is really a wonderful statement about humanity, that even in their last days of life, that it was important that they still mattered and that they be heard. So it was just this kind of paternalistic view of how we care for people at the end of their life that actually ends up isolating them, and dying's already lonely. And I think that was kind of the take home from the research. And here we are, you know, many, many years later, hundreds and hundreds of patients later, and everybody really wants to participate. The only thing they say no to sometimes is being filmed, unless they get their hair done or something like that. But even surprisingly, they actually want to be filmed.
So let's talk a little bit just about how you do the research. So it's one thing to, I guess, get approval to go ahead and do the study. But how did you set it up? I mean, how do you have observers there that are just watching? And you mentioned videotape, and you also mentioned some survey instruments. Is that how you record or measure dreams?
Yeah, we have a research team. We've been doing this so long. So we take care of about 1,000 people a day at our organization between hospice and palliative care. And we have a 22-bed inpatient unit and about 450 patients in hospice home care. And our clinical folks usually identify people who are having these experiences. And then we ask them if they want to would be willing to talk to our research team or participate in a study. And again, the vast majority of people say yes. And then one of members of our research team goes and conducts an interview, and oftentimes they're followed up by filming. So sometimes it's sort of, but it's usually direct interviewing.
Have you speculate in the book a little bit, but I'm curious to hear your formulation of it. But what do these dreams mean, these end-of-life dreams or visions?
One of the things that we've been very careful to do, our goal to do, and I think this is why it's gotten such attention internationally, is that we did not want to, the temptation is to look at this through a lens of afterlife and religion. And what we really simply wanted to do is translate the dying experience in the words and the images of the patients themselves without speculating. I think where we end up is that, you know, dying's a mystery unto itself without it being a harbinger of anything after death. And just this notion that, you know, we understand dying in terms of physical dimensions and organ failure and that sort of thing, but that there was something subjective or something experienced. I think that there's a better story. I think that it's this period that heightens our introspection and review of life. And if you look at our results, what seems to happen is the people who you've loved and who've loved you the best and nurtured you the best aren't really lost in the sense that they return. So it's very, very common to have somebody in their eighth or ninth decade in life and have lost a parent, let's say, at 5 or 6, and for them to feel that they're present and of comfort. So it's this almost final justice where the people who didn't love you right aren't included. You know, we've had people who've been married 3 times and they loved the second spouse and that person returns. And it's a way of almost putting people back together. So the pivotal moments of your life, it could be an experience with war or something that brought you proximate to death, or the person who loved you or forgave you, those moments seem to return.
But you're very clear that these kinds of pre-death dreams are very different and not at all the same thing from near-death experiences.
Yeah, you're right. We actually don't have white lights and tunnels phenomena. If you think about it, they're entirely different. So in one case, you're looking at somebody who's actively dying. They die clinically, and they return. And they seem to come back, I don't know a lot about it, but they come back with a message or a motivation towards something. If you think about our folks, the time for therapy is over. They don't come out of this with questions or a platform or a big message. It's not like that at all. It's just some kind of reacquaintance with something from having lived. But they don't come out and ask, hey, what does this mean? You know, we did an interesting study where we actually looked at dying as post-traumatic death. And we compared people who were having these experiences versus those who weren't. And it was really interesting. In fact, they do show all the signs on various scales of post-traumatic death. So what it tells us is that despite their life ending, they are actually adapting. They're gaining insight and understanding, and that's actually measurable compared to those people who aren't.
So you mentioned some of the findings from research. For example, you found out that the number of dreams accelerates as the patient gets closer to the end of life, which I thought was really interesting.
Dramatically. Well, it's interesting because it's also predictive and prognostic, right? So, and that's what actually got me into this work was that I came into this from cardiology. I was training cardiology, and the nurses that were actually taking care of the patients and the social workers and pastoral care, they were predicting somebody's death based on them having these experiences, which I thought was crazy. And so what we did was, that was one of the points of measuring this every day, and it's actually true. It's, you can prognosticate in part by patients having these experiences.
Yeah, and there's a great scene in the book and also I think in your TEDx talk where you talk about this nurse, I think her name's Nancy, who has all this wisdom accumulated from years of caring for dying patients, and you're just essentially working on the weekend moonlighting to make some extra money.
And actually, having no idea what I was doing.
You wanted to save all these patients' lives and do all this medical stuff to them, and you were kind of missing the forest for the trees there.
Yeah, she actually laughed. She actually didn't look up from charting and just said, no, he's dying. He's seen his deceased mother. And what I do is I looked in the literature, and there was an awful lot in the humanities. Every culture has written about this, but very little in medicine except for anecdotal stories. Kind of clinical vignettes. So that's why then I tried to teach it, and nobody was accepting it. It was easier to medicalize it, you know, and say, you know, was somebody confused or whatever. And so that's why we did the study, was to prove that point. And what was interesting was there was very little response in the medical community, but it quickly went around the world, which is telling because there's a significant discrepancy between the people who provide care and the people who receive the care. I think is interesting. Telling.
Say more about that. What do you mean in terms of people who provide the care? You mean the doctor, the medical community?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that there's so little response on the medical side of the community, and we're the ones who are actually caring for the patient, yet the response on the non-medical side is overwhelming. And I think what's lost here is that and we've shown this in the studies, is there's obviously something inherently therapeutic, and not just for the patient, but for their loved one. And I think we have an obligation to address all forms of suffering, beyond the physical, obviously. And at the end, dying is a closing of a life more than it is anything else. And there's an opportunity to translate this, at least for the patient and for the family. And so our conversation is basically give permission for this to happen by saying, you know, this is not uncommon. There's actually some data that people will withhold these experiences for fear of being ridiculed or judged. So I think it's really important to at least give it acceptance, acknowledgement, and space.
And your work, essentially, if I understand it correctly, shows that, and you sort of alluded to this, but overwhelmingly that dying patients have these dreams and that they're usually quite positive about deceased people that have loved them throughout their life. But you do write that not all of the dreams are positive or, you know, leading to happiness. Some of them are indeed, you know, troubling.
Oh, very. About 17%, when we ask people to rate it on a distressing or comfort or discomfort, rate them as discomforting. But I think actually some of the discomforting dreams turn out to be the most meaningful dreams. So it's not like this is rainbows and birds singing. You know, people die how they live. But that's often enormous opportunities. And there's a great video of a gentleman who had been in jail for most of his life, and he had had neck cancer, and he dreamt he was being stabbed by all the people he was harmed.
Mm.
And he was somebody who basically couldn't live looking backwards or with regret. It was more survival. And he came out of these experiences with a powerful need to reach out to his daughter and express his love and to say he was sorry. And it was actually caught on film. And it's one of the most touching, moving things I've ever seen. And so while the dream was certainly distressing and discomforting, it could not have been more meaningful. And it allowed him to close his eyes differently and dying really is progressive sleep, and you have to be comfortable, not just physically, but psychologically. And his daughter didn't leave his bedside. So it changed the trajectory of his dying, but it came from a painful place. But it was accurate to how he lived.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Chris Kerr. He is a doctor and the CEO and Chief Medical Officer of Hospice Buffalo. He has a new book out called Death is But a Dream, Finding Hope and Meaning at Life's End. And Chris, you mentioned how you started in hospice care, doing it on weekends and not really knowing what you were doing. But you do relate in the book a very personal story that your own father died when you were very young. You were, I think, 12. And there was a poignant scene in the book where your father was on his deathbed, although I think at the time you didn't know that. And he reached over to you and touched the buttons on your jacket or sweater and said he was going to take you fishing. It was just so, it was beautifully rendered, but very sad. And what I guess shocked me and hurt me on your behalf was that there was a priest there who made you go away and leave your father so that you couldn't attend or be there when he died.
Yeah, it's actually the last memory I have of my father, last time I saw him. And, I think it's a natural, well-intended impulse that we protect children from certain realities. But it was funny because, I actually remember knowing that he wasn't himself, but wherever he was actually in a good place because we're Canadian, and we'd go fishing up north every year, and that no matter where he was, we were together. And that gave me comfort. I had already seen him decimated with disease. I that pain was real, but to see him more spiritually in a place and with me meant an enormous amount to me. And it was funny, it was not something I was comfortable talking about. What happened was I wrote the TED Talk and I made no mention of it. I just wasn't comfortable. And then I just realized how I was very aware of it, because when I started working at hospice, I saw these people reaching and calling out, and it was exactly what I'd seen in my childhood and really didn't want it to go back to. And I sat with this friend, and I said, this is probably the most intellectually dishonest thing I could ever do, was to talk about this as though I didn't have a personal side to this for me. There wasn't something that mattered, and it did. So I changed the TED Talk, and that's where it started.
Well, it's definitely formative in how your career, I think, wound up turning out. And you have experience in pastoral care, or at least working with people in pastoral care. And I'm wondering if nowadays, if there was a clergy person, a priest, would they do the same thing, or would they be more understanding of children, or they would at least defer to the wish of the other parent, perhaps?
I think it would depend on the sophistication. I think we don't sterilize kids quite the same way. I think obviously would need to be translated. But I think, it's like anything that creates a barrier to the bedside doesn't, in the end, help the grieving. You want to bring closer and humanize the process, not remove. It didn't go away for me because I was taken out of the room. I was just left with a little more emptiness for it.
Yeah. Well, and you told us earlier that you were training as a cardiologist. You also happen to have a PhD, so you're highly qualified in of all things, neurobiology. So I guess probably a lot of people, at least at the time you made the career switch, wondered, and I guess, listeners will wonder, how did you wind up doing this from that background?
Well, it was interesting. I loved acute medicine. I, like many young people in medicine, I loved the death-defying aspect of it. Entranced by it, the technology and all that you could do. At the same time, medicine had other demands on it that was making it less of a human-to-human or more of a depersonalized experience between all the time documenting and whatnot and time with patients. And I just saw an ad in the paper, came here working on weekends where you were really allowed to be present. And I knew that, what we do is hard, and if it has meaning, the hours and the commitments and late nights are more than tolerable. And so I saw, when I came here, I saw this personalized side of medicine where I was taking care of the person more in totality that I knew was more meaningful to me. that I could contribute to. And so it was a hard switch because at the time, you know, cardiologists were making a lot more money than a hospice doctor, and it was a prestigious subspecialty and whatnot. So, a fair amount of ridicule.
Chris, let's talk about, you alluded earlier to sort of special cases in the book. For example, couples that have been married for more than 50 years. You have a chapter or two on children that are dying, and then another chapter on vulnerable or disabled persons. And I thought that was just really interesting that you sort of these death dreams really sort of cover the lifespan. I mean, for people of all abilities, backgrounds, ethnicities, you know, marital status, et cetera, even of course, for people you alluded to a little bit earlier, multiple traumas. So it seems like, I think your research kind of bears this out, that this is something that's almost universal.
Yeah, it's part of the human experience. And I loved particularly the part on children probably and those with different minds, because they're typically excluded from research based on consent. And we tend to think of them in terms of their cognitive deficits and not the fact that they've had an emotional life that necessarily isn't lost or compromised. And that comes so to the surface at the end of their lives that it's just a great story to be able to share.
Yeah, it was very touching. And, you know, I guess the other thing I wanted to ask you about, and you write about this a few times in the book, which is, you know, having had this training in medicine and then cardiology and being enamored of all the latest technical wizardry and sort of learning, I guess, personally, you know, what had more meaning to you, was that a lot of times for a dying patient, in fact, probably many times, you say there's really nothing I can do medically but bear witness, just sit there and listen. And I thought that was so powerful.
Well, you think about, we say this in medicine all the time, and I think it's the worst words that a clinician can say, which is there's nothing more we can do for you. And that's true if you think of your role as curative only. But we have a dual obligation, which is to comfort when we can't cure. So our role of comforture, of providing comforture, isn't dependent on outcome. And when we allow ourselves to play that role, and sometimes it's presence, it's non-abandonment. And we see this all the time in our patients and families who come out of a hospitalization, and there is this feeling like the floor fell beneath them and that they were let go, because our healthcare system is world class when we're deemed treatable, but it becomes something else when we're not.
Well, the book really is a testament to presence, and Hospice Buffalo and your research, your work is really providing that kind of spiritual comfort for dying patients and their families. The name of the book is Death is But a Dream, Finding Hope and Meaning at Life's End. And it's by my guest today, Chris Kerr, who is the Chief Medical Officer and CEO of Hospice Buffalo. Chris, thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. I really appreciate your time.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.